I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. Scottish-American novelist Douglas Stewart hit the literary scene in 2020 with his Booker Prize-winning debut novel, Shuggie Bane. His second novel, Young Mungo, was also published to critical acclaim in 2022. Stewart's newest novel, John of John, follows a young adult named Cal, who has recently returned to his home settlement of Fallabay on the remote Isle of Harris in Scotland. Cal, whose formal name is John, struggles to get along with his father, John, and he also struggles as his modern habits conflict with the tradition and deeply religious community he grew up in. I recently spoke with Douglas Stewart about John of John, and here's our conversation. So when John of John opens, one of our main characters, Cal, is recalling a recent conversation with his father, John, that he had while Cal was in a phone booth. He is in Edinburgh, and his father is, you know, back in his, you know, a fictional town or settlement of Fallabay, is part of Scotland's remote Western Isles. Can you set the book up for our readers from here? What's going on? And maybe this will explain the title. Who is John of John?
That's right. Yeah. Well, thank you, Beth. Both men are actually called John, father and son, although the son goes by the name Cal. And he has just graduated from art school from Textile College. And he thinks he's at that wonderful moment that all young people have where they're going to go out into the world and become themselves. And he receives a call from his father back home on the island he grew up on, saying that his grandmother, his father's mother-in-law, but his Cal's grandmother is sick and that Cal has to come home and take care of her because she's his responsibility. So Cal, loving his grandmother very much, puts down his own life. He's sort of floundering on the mainland anyway. He can't find work and he's couch surfing and having a tough time. But he's a very dutiful grandson. And so he returns home to the small settlement of Fallabay, which is on the east coast of the Isle of Harris. It only has 26 people in it. And like many rural places, it's very depopulated and the population is aging. But he returns home to the island and to take care of his grandmother. But the moment he gets home, he realizes his grandmother seems to be in very fine health. And she is exactly as he left her. And so this returns him, I suppose, to a place where he has a lot of unfinished business, a lot of broken relationships. But he's also wondering why he's been called home.
You know, we learn a bit about our setting, you know, this island and the people who live there, from Cal's perspective with this line, and this is a quote: "Most young men went to the sea, worked the land, or were wrapped up in the cloth, either the ministry or the tweed." And I want to explore both of these cloths with you, but let's start with the tweed. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, this practice, the strict code among weavers, the number of looms in a home, the number of weavers per cloth, the family license? I mean, this wasn't a large focus of the novel necessarily, but it was part of the setting that I found fascinating.
Well, I was actually a textile student myself. I didn't study English literature, so it was almost inevitable that I was going to write about cloth. And Harris tweed is this really miraculous, beautiful cloth that comes from the islands, can only come from the islands. It is centuries old. And the idea was, is whenever the crofters who turned to the sea or to the land to support their families, whenever they were having a tough time there, they could always make cloth in order to make a living. And so anyone who is a weaver on the islands would have a shed behind their home, and in that shed would have one loom. And there is an accreditation that says that one weaver to one cloth, and everything must be made on the islands and finished on the islands, and it receives a royal stamp. You know, I think when the world was industrializing and everything was made in these huge mills and these huge factories, it probably looked quite quaint. And then towards the end of the 21st century, or the 20th century rather, it probably looked a little outdated. But now, because they make Harris tweed in exactly the same way that they've made for centuries, actually, I think it's a very rare thing in the world, you know, to have something made in the West by hand at home by someone and to have it be this very beautiful thing. You know, all the colors of the cloth come from the land around them. So if they're inspired to use a pink or a yellow, it's because it comes from, you know, the sunset or from the lichen or from the color of the water. And so the men in the book are engaged in making this textile in this shed behind their home. For Cal, it feels a little bit like a trap because it means not only is he home, but he's working for and with his father. And for John, it's just his way of life. It's what he has done. He comes from a long line of weavers, and he just takes an enormous pride in it. But I would say, cloth works as a metaphor in the novel because John is a very devout Christian. And so for him, weaving is about following a pre-laid out plan. It's someone else's plan, and you execute to it. And you make this cloth where there are thousands of threads cooperating, doing exactly as they should do, and making this pattern that's a larger pattern. And for Cal, he feels a little bit of rebellion in that because he wants to create his own wonderful textiles and his own cloths. And he's actually a knitter by trade, and knitting fundamentally is one thread looping on itself over and over again and doing whatever it wants. Any knitter will know that you can start thinking you're knitting a sweater and then ultimately you end up knitting a dress or something else. And so it really, their preferences really talk to the personality of father and son.
You know, you touched on John and religion. So let's talk about the cloth in terms of ministry. Because here's another quote from Cal's perspective. The mainlanders saw the Free Presbyterians as the fire and brimstone set, as deeply old-fashioned, terminally uncool, a little frightening. What's happening with religion on this island?
Yeah, I mean, Scotland is probably primarily a Protestant nation. And Protestantism did a lot for the country. It gave us some of the highest literacy rates in the world when we went through the Reformation. Up on the islands is a minority sect of Calvinism, the Free Presbyterianism. And they are a very good, very gentle people, but they believe in quite a difficult path to God. They don't negotiate the scripture. They believe very much in the word of the Bible as the infallible word of God. And to the rest of us in Scotland, they do seem a little extreme often. But even though they're a minority religion, they have a huge effect on the larger Scottish psyche. That often comes from their belief in predestination, that we're all born in sin, we're born in depravity, and you can give yourself to Jesus, but most of us are destined for hell because we are sinners. And so that, I think, is what Cal means when he's talking about the perception of the broader country, when he understands that this is his home and these are his people and he loves them. But he knows because he's been on the mainland that people from the big city sort of see them as a little bit, ooh, extreme and conservative. And so he's caught between those two things.
I did feel like there were reflections of biblical themes throughout the book, the prodigal son with Sorley and Ennis. And I felt like there were a couple of instances of, saving the one lost lamb, or was I just imagining that?
No, I mean, absolutely. Biblical texts were so central to me writing the novel. And in fact, I was a young man who had probably strayed very far from faith. And so it was a good opportunity for me to return to the text and to think not just about what they would mean to the community, but also how they have shaped Cal's identity. There's a passage in the book that says John really follows the season with the Bible because every night the family worship together, every morning they worship together. And John likes to sort of turn to Galatians for the gentle lambing season. And whenever he's angry with Cal, he turns to Deuteronomy because there's some great passages in the Bible there that talk about disobedient sons. And Cal can kind of feel when that's coming on, when his father is starting to get a little angry with him. And he's heard it so many times from his father that almost he can repeat it right back to him before his father has to say it. He knows the Bible passages by heart.
It seems that just about every single character in this book was holding on to a significant secret. And I don't want to spoil any, but can you talk about the theme of secrecy, specifically secrecy to preserve a traditional way of life?
Yeah, I was thinking very much about inheritance when I was writing the book, and there is a central theme about physical inheritance. Does Cal want this croft and this farmhouse and this land that his father has spent decades maintaining? But there is also what we inherit from our family around our ideas of ourselves and who we're allowed to be. It's why the book is called John of John. The word of is really the operative thing in the title. And when you meet islanders, they might ask you who you are, but because names are very common, family names go on for centuries on the islands, and Christian names are often named after their father or mother, then they have to very quickly ask you, who do you belong to? And that's really the question of the book, who do you belong to? But Cal is a young gay man, and he's gone to the mainland, and he's sort of unfurled a little bit. He's found a sense of himself, but as soon as he's called back home, he has to sort of put himself away and abide by his father's rules. But what seems like the returning of a prodigal son is actually not about that at all. It's about the people he left behind. And his father has also been struggling with his own identity. His father, I think it's revealed in the second chapter, so it's not a spoiler, is also, he wouldn't call himself gay because gay is a social designation, but he has a love and an attraction for another man. And so John, the elder, is sort of struggling with coming to terms with who he is. And for me as a writer, I grew up around a lot of men who were very hardworking, very bright, but they would do just about everything they could to not talk about feelings and to avoid the emotional truth. You know, they sort of kept their own feelings very well hidden. And so as a writer, it was a technical exercise to see if I could create this claustrophobia with his family in this house, have them work and worship and love one another and eat together, but then also have them not face the emotional truth between them. How close could I make a father and son without them addressing the thing that was right there on the table between them?
You know, I didn't even think of Cal as the prodigal son. I thought of Sorley because he went off to school and used all the money that Innes had earned. So I'm sorry I missed that.
Well, one of the things about the novel is that history keeps repeating itself.
That's
So
true.
Cal's story is actually reflected in their neighbors. You're so right. But you know, when Cal shows up with that wild appearance on the first chapter of the novel, I think everybody thinks, "Huh, here he comes."
Yeah, there you go. You're listening to Marginalia. We're speaking with author Douglas Stewart about his novel, John of John. So, whenever I read a book, if other book titles are mentioned in that book, I start to take note. And this novel included several, like Swan's Way and Wuthering Heights and The Wasp Factory. And then there was mention of Virginia Woolf's, and I'm quoting the book here, To the Lighthouse, which offended everybody. It's set on Skye, and there's hardly a Scotsman in it. It's a particularly English talent that, the ability to visit foreign places and yet always think of yourself as the most interesting thing there. Do the books mentioned throughout have special significance to you, or like with To the Lighthouse, do they provide an avenue for a commentary, or both?
Yeah, one of the things I first of all wanted to upend is sometimes we think rural working men are not very curious about culture or not very well read. Certainly in Britain, in the media, they can often be portrayed as a little backwards. And I spent 16 weeks on the island and I found that to absolutely be false. I found crofters, farmers to be better read than even I was, and to be sometimes they could be better traveled because they were the sea was part of their life and they would join the merchant navy as young men and they would go all around the world. And so I just really wanted to write about farmers who loved books and who would get together as part of a church group and just men. You know, we take it often that women will do this, but I wanted working men to get together and to read big texts and to discuss it and to bond over it. And they are susceptible to the heartbreak in Wuthering Heights, and they get outraged that Virginia Woolf would come to Scotland, set a whole novel there, and have no Scottish characters or hardly any. And so they sort of, you know, they have thoughts about novels. And that for me was really important to state because I think often when we think about islands or novels set on islands, we think of them as lost in time or through the mists and fogs, and it's a world very different to our own. And that's not true. All modern problems and all modern challenges and life exists in rural places. It's just we often don't center them in narratives. And so having men reading books was a way just to say they are part of a larger world. One of the books that is mentioned and might not be familiar to American readers is The Wasp Factory by a great Scottish writer, Ian Banks. And that also takes place on an island. And it's a book that sort of plays with gender, but it also plays with a young man coming really fully off the rails and doing, you know, committing quite heinous crimes. And I think Cal keeps turning to that book through his return home and sort of almost as a comfort read, thinking, no matter how bad I'm acting, I'm not quite there yet.
So I could ask the same question about the music in the book. Is the music mentioned personal to you?
Yeah, every time before I start a novel, I create a playlist actually for each of the characters, and they're always very different. And whenever I turn to a page where the character is featured, I play the music over and over so that I can sort of think about the things they might like and get a vibe or a feeling for them. Yeah, Cal has a Walkman and he sort of tramps around the island listening to music and is often by himself. But his father is very angry about this because really rock and roll can contain a lot of things that are not within his idea of a clean living man. You know, it's a bad influence. But for me, making the playlist for Cal was so important. You know, it has the Smiths and the Inspiral Carpets. And there is a scene where John is having a moment of romance and he listens to Nana Mouskouri. And I was thinking even about gay men of a certain generation, how we always have a fondness for these big female singers. You know, every generation has this sort of tragic female singer, I think, that we just take to our heart as a gay culture. And I think even John, as a deacon in the local church, would not be immune to that.
I do have to say that one of my favorite sentences in the book, of which there were many, had to do with music. Cal never cared much for Depeche Mode in the first place, but he wouldn't lose an argument to a man who couldn't spell unnecessary. So this book is serious, but it's also funny. How do you balance the two?
You know, I do think there is just something inherent in Scottish character where we try not to take ourselves too seriously. And I always found, certainly growing up in Glasgow, there was a really close juxtaposition between tragedy and comedy. You know, often when we had the saddest time as a family, the only thing we had to leaven it was really a little a joke. You know, we always tried to look a little bit on the bright side. And I just tried to bring that to my writing. I think comedy is a natural part of life. But as a writer, it's a little manipulative to use humor, you know, because I find if I can sort of keep you laughing or just keep you feeling warm towards me, you step a little closer, you come a little closer as I'm telling you a story. And then in that moment, I can tell you something very profoundly true and sad. And so I am sort of engaging a reader to keep them sort of engaged and to keep them trusting me before I drop some truth on them. But Cal is a young man with a really deep sense of humor, and he's come home for his grandmother, who he loves deeply. And in the household, if John is the center of the house, if he has all control as the father, Cal and his grandmother Ella feel like outsiders. But Ella is a woman who has arrived from the mainland 50 years ago from Glasgow. And she and Cal have a very special friendship, a very special bond, and they find great solace with one another. And one of their favorite things to do is Ella loves to collect insults. She loves to collect really obscure ways to insult men. And so when every time Cal comes home from the mainland, he tells her what the kids today are saying, or sort of he brings her new insults, and they spend many a happy afternoon just trading those back and forth. She was so much fun to write.
Your sentences are so nuanced, so descriptive, for major and minor characters alike. For example, we meet one of the characters, Billy, not in person, but only through a personal ad, a letter, and a family photo. Cal looks at that photo and says of Billy, "There was a gleam in his eye that said he was certain he was his mother's favorite." And I'm not even sure if I have a question here. I guess I'm wondering, do you work and worry your manuscript? Do you read it aloud? How do you consistently deliver such nuance throughout these, almost 400 pages?
Oh, well, thank you. You know, I think the book took me 7 years to write, but it's, you know, it's hard work, but it's also a pleasure for me. Part of it is inventing people and then spending time getting to know them and allowing them to tell me things. I often start with a loose plot for the novel, and as I write on, the characters become very real to me. And when they can start to go in any direction of their own free will, they will then turn to me and say, "I don't want to do what you told me to do." And I find I have to throw out the plot of the novel entirely because I've spent so much time investing in these people. But yeah, it's, you know, it's just such a pleasure. I think I am a writer who enjoys human nature above all else. And part of the reason why I write is to reflect ourselves back at ourselves, to introduce you to people and hopefully let you recognize yourself in these characters. And so until I've spent time with all my minor characters and they feel very real to me, I don't feel like a novel is ever done. But one thing that was a joy for me in writing this book is about those correspondences, about these personal ads. You know, the book is set in 1996, and I was a young gay man then when there was no ability to go to clubs or to access a pub or to find my own community. And so I used to respond to personal ads in the back of teen magazines. And, when I was writing the novel, I found these boxes of letters that I wrote when I was 16 and 17, and they were incredibly innocent compared to what people do on social media and dating sites now. But, I would write and I would correspond long form with these strangers for months and months and months. And I was like a Bronte sister, I would sort of talk about my family and how I felt in the city and all these things, and then ask them. And it would, letters would go on for 10 and 12 pages. But when I was writing the book and I was thinking about Cal looking for love, I turned to these letters again. And when I wasn't cringing at myself, I sort of was returned to a time of innocence. And even looking at photos, when you talk about Billy in that photo, he sees what he's sure is his mother's favorite. It was a time before selfies, and it was a time before we turned cameras on ourselves. You would often get a photo that was taken at a family event or someone sitting in their grandmother's garden wearing the shoes they got for Christmas or the new shirt. And it was incredibly vulnerable to see young men like this looking very proud, but also sort of observed by their family. And I don't know, I was very touched and I had to write about it.
Well, I think another one of my favorite of your sentences that I marked was when Cal was thinking about these ads that people would place. And here's the quote. He couldn't tell who he felt the sorriest for, those few whose solitude had allowed them to flourish with weird niche interests, Renee Fleming, Moorish architecture, canal boat holidays, or the other who had no interest and were nothing but a list of verbs, walking, traveling, reading. I just loved that.
It's so true. It's so true. And I was looking back at the ads and I was thinking everything at the time would say sincere. I'm a sincere man looking for, sincere love. I think there was sort of a sad desperation in it as well. They were letting you know they were genuine. They didn't want to play around anymore. They really were looking to find someone very special. But it was such a inspiration for the novel to go back and to look at all that and to catch my younger self as well, and to think about my own search for love when I was 17. But one of the things I remember is I found my actual first love through one of these ads, and we corresponded for 6 months before we ever met, and I fell in love with them. But I did it again a little later, a few years later, after that relationship broke up, and I was corresponding with another man that I thought was 18 or 19. And when we finally met, he turned out to be 46. And I was thinking recently, catfishing has always been alive and well.
I feel like most of the sentences, your sentences that I've read back to you were from Cal's perspective. But you include multiple perspectives in the book. And I guess this is more of a question about craft. But I'm wondering how you approach different perspectives as a writer, because you mentioned having a playlist for each character. But each character has their own personal history and manner of speaking and age and gender. So talk to me about challenges in nailing a perspective like Cal's and then switching to a different perspective.
Yeah, I think that's where the majority of the work in my novels goes, is sort of trying to find these characters, then find the tension between them. I draw a lot of triangles at the beginning, and there is a relationship happening between son, father, and grandmother, but there's also a love triangle between three men that emerges in the novel. And then there's also a triangle. Cal is in a relationship with Doll, who's his best friend, but he's also betrothed to Doll's sister. And so that becomes a very tense thing. And when I understand how characters are colliding in this world, then my job is to make them feel very real and almost like they could leap off the page at any moment. And part of my desire for that is, you're only glimpsing people at a period in their life, but I want readers to get to the end of my novels and feel that the characters could go on forever. And almost for the readers to worry about characters when I'm finished, to leave a story before the story is really truly finished, almost in the midpoint, so that really I'm giving these people to you and they become part of your life. If I can achieve that, then I feel like the novel is finished and it is ready. But yeah, I spend a lot of time thinking about vocal differences, how people would approach a situation. One of the things that I think was an important lesson to me as a young man that I didn't realize was valuable until I became a writer was I was the son of a single mother, and my mother was a wonderful woman, but my mother suffered with terrible addiction, which meant even as a child, I never felt that feeling of me being the most important thing in the room or the family. I knew from the age of 4 that I had to keep all my eyes on my mother at all time and read the smallest shifts in her behavior or her mood, because however that moved or however that changed would affect everything about her day. And so I was an incredibly watchful child, but I was always watching for the smallest differences in her. And I think as a kid, that filled me with anxiety and it never let me rest. But as a writer, that's not a bad place to start, like really tune into the finer details of people and everything that crosses their mind and their interiority.
In the acknowledgments, you briefly mention your time visiting the Western Isles of Scotland in 2019 as you waited for your debut novel, Shuggie Bain, to be published. And that was in 2019. This book is set in the 1990s, and it almost does feel like a story from another time, even predating the 90s in a way. So I'm wondering about challenges or benefits from setting a novel in the 90s. I mean, you already mentioned there were no selfies, there were no, and with that, there are no cell phones. I mean, they were using a payphone. But talk to me about any advantages or challenges of setting a novel at this time and place.
Yeah, I think so much of my work is often characters trying to belong in the only place they feel they belong, but feeling very ill at ease at that. And so I deliberately set the novel in 1996, 1997, because it's before the internet comes to the world. And the internet does revolutionize rural places, It often also allows businesses to spring up and industries to change very drastically. And I just thought, I don't want to be there yet in the islands. I want to focus on the settlement where the entire universe is these 26 people. Many of them, like rural places, are aging, and there's not many young people and there's not much opportunity. But I just wanted the whole universe to be this one fictional settlement of Thalaby. It also, it presents lots of challenges in communication. You have to write letters, you have to go to a phone box, you have to do these other things, but it also allows for an increasing sort of warping of reality, I think. Or, families, I think, when they are in isolation, start to take on behaviors that can become quite absurd or become very strange. And if they're not checked by the outside world, or when someone visits them from the outside world and looks at them, you only really then realize that they're doing something that's quite peculiar. But to the family, it's very normal. And one of the things I was thinking about there was Ella, the grandmother. While Carol has been at college, she had bought herself a sunbed. But she just likes to turn the sunbed on. She doesn't lie under it. She just likes to turn it on and just be in the room with it, because often in the winter she misses the sun. And so sort of setting it in that time away from reaching the wider world allowed me just to imbue the characters with lots of peculiar behaviors, I think.
Do you have a hope for what readers will take away from John of John?
Anytime in the past that I've had a hope, readers have sort of gone beyond my hopes and think just surprise me very deeply, So I tend to not have that. I tend to wait for the moment where readers meet a book and then just delight in what they take from it and be surprised. I think you have an idea of what it is you've written and what you've tried to write, but you don't really know what that is until people reflect it back at you. And then you think, oh, was that really what I was going for the whole time? Writing is a part of a process of getting to know yourself as an author. And what is this I'm trying to excavate inside myself that's been bothering me all these years? So no, I hope what I always hope with my books, and that's when the final page turns, the characters live with the readers and they feel very real in the world. And I love it when I meet a reader and they say to me, I wonder what Shuggie is doing now. Is he okay? And I always say, yeah, he's okay. He's okay. He tells me he's okay.
Is Cal okay?
I don't want to spoil anything for anybody, but I would say everyone's going to be okay.
Well, the book is John of John. Douglas Stewart, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Beth. It's been a pleasure.
John of John by Douglas Stewart was published by Picador. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen and Lou Ann Stevens. Torin Anderson composed our theme music. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.